Ladies and gentlemen, good day and welcome to the Roundtable Plus webinar on emerging structures for investments in real estate with a special focus on recent tax and regulatory developments. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode, and there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions after the presentation concludes. Should you need assistance during the conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star then zero on your touchtone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. Participants who have joined on video conference and wish to ask questions during the Q&A session are requested to dial in on the primary number provided in the invite, that is 022-3938-1004. I repeat, it's 022-3938-1004. I'm now glad to hand the conference over to Mr. Ruchir Sinha. Thank you, and over to you, sir.
Thank you very much. I think thank you for everyone to join us. Maybe Yashit Bhai, you want to just give...
No, all that I would say is most welcome. It's been wonderful to have you all here unexpectedly because there are 64 and we got in-person registering about 173 and on four about another 200 people. And it shows all the interest, and we should not be making too many speeches, but I think come to the meat of the whole thing. I'm really excited to receive you all and all the people on the phone from Eastern Hemisphere and the Western Hemisphere and from all over India. So my warm welcome to you all, and we are in an exciting time. And we'll see even more exciting time once January 20th comes and Mr. Trump takes it. So let's see how it's going to unfold itself. Really, even interest rates already been going up the other side. And, a lot of new measures have been proposed in the U.S., including taxes and stuff like that. So how that part is going to impact us, I read in the newspaper that $17 billion have been withdrawn by NRIs. And stuff like that. So, of course, some of my colleagues would have also a perspective on that, but I'm just mentioning that 2017 starts in a very, very interesting way. And but I believe India is resilient. We'll come out of all the things that I think an impact of demonetization probably, would begin to taper off a bit. Let us see how it unfolds itself. There are two points of view. One is very good, but it is very bad. But we know there is somewhere along the line there which has a bad side. But, and again, I do not want to preempt both my colleagues as you speak. But it would be wonderful to see how we wade our way in the pandemic to come. Because there are all different situations. Only time will tell whether they were right or what was right. But today, it would be interesting to see what are the steps we can take and what new opportunities exist in front of us. So I'm always an eternal optimist, positive thinker, and we can always turn negatives into positive. So with those words, I would welcome. And Ruchir.
No, thank you very much. I think we have exactly about 15 minutes from now to kind of conclude our sessions. We'd like to keep it short, crisp, and we'll have about 30 minutes from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for any questions that you may have. Those on the call, if you have any questions, please send an email to rewebinar2017.nda. rewebinar2017@ruchirsinha.com to us, and we will look at those questions and we'll address them during the Q&A session. Now, I will not spend too much time on introductions. I think you all have a copy of, you have a lot of collections with you. You also have a copy of the invite. We have Suresh from Apollo, one of the larger funds looking at India, which has kind of done very successful investment in the past, and I think pretty active in the Indian context. We have showed it as many vectors, capital markets, JLL, someone who we work personally very, very closely, and he's been a consistent factor in all our webinars, because whenever we do something, Shobhan is always there with us. And as some people would know, he knows everything what is happening within the private equity real estate industry and the capital market.
Would you be taking questions online or the only right email?
No, we'll be doing a Q&A also here. So either they send any emails, we will address that. I head the real estate practice and provide the private equity M&A practice. Nishchal heads the P and the M&A practice, and I have Abhinav, who is now our new emerging leader for the real estate investment, private equity investment in real estate practice. So, and I think if you want to know more about us, you have the profiles. You can look at it. Let's now very, very quickly start with the session. I think the flavor of the season seems largely to be demonetization. And I think we are getting mixed views from every side. At one stage, you know, some of our primary equity funds have been saying, you know, they're very happy with demonetization because somewhere down the line, I think it is going to inculcate ethical behavior. And from a foreign investor perspective, I think that ethical behavior is probably the most important thing. So yes, there has been a demand slowdown, possibly that the market will get a little fishy for the next couple of quarters, but I think overall, at least our sense has been that they are happy, but I'll let Suresh comment on the data, but maybe Shobhit, you see this very, very closely day in, day out, and your interactions have probably been the most. So how do you see demonetization shaping up for the Indian real estate sector and also the real estate sector in general in the next couple of quarters?
Thank you, Rishit, for the opportunity. First of all, I'd like to thank Ms. Bhai for giving such a positive start, and also for the fact that this year is starting the first conference of real estate, which is being so well oversubscribed. So I'm quite happy to see the investor interest. I think on demonetization itself, we can go on talking for the whole day, but I'll keep it very limited to be direct or indirect impacts on real estate. The good news is the office sector is not affected. So that sector continues to have good demand and prices remain very stable. Let's follow the next sector, which is retail. I think consumption has tapered off a little bit. Retailers are very F&B in a drop in demand for an interim period. So it is coming back. So if the sales were at 100, they went down to about 60. They're now going back probably at 80. Looks like by March, money in circulation. It looks like it's going to come back pretty okay. It may even cross the previous peak in terms of sales per square feet. I think the sector that suffered the most is residential, about 85% of our market. And I think that's behaving differently in different cities, but the undertone is that sales have slowed down. Almost all cities are affected. Most is NCR region, at least is Bangalore. But in any case, like I said, if you have to pick up one tone, it is that sales have been constantly slowing. And the reason could be many. I mean, people talked about black money going out of the market. People talked about investor-led sales. These are retail investors not wanting to buy at this point of time, stuff like that. But the biggest reason at the moment is sentiment, because people don't know where this is going to end. I think every 2 weeks you've been in on demonetization of changing how much money is going to come back, what will be the next effect on country's balance sheet and economy. I think that numbers are out now. But the media continues to believe that real estate is going to see a big price correction. So almost virtually home buyers are waiting to say, look, if the media is saying it and everybody else is saying it, let's wait for 2 more months. See what sort of go and happen. And anyway, price are not rising. That's very clear. So there's no harm in waiting. So all the decisions on residential purchase are getting postponed. That's one big effect. Second is that, yes, discounts are available on residential. I think as opposed to the market view, which is saying high-end is affected most, we believe that high-end is probably less affected. It is the mid-market which is getting slaughtered at this point. Because the high end is able to negotiate their deals. If you're buying a $2-3 million home, you can sit and negotiate. But the price tag itself is now going to come down. And hence the sort of what you call as the classic mid-market is waiting for something to happen. And I'm not sure whether they're going to get this good news pretty soon. The other thing is that if we believe that there was cash in real estate transactions and that cash transactions should be effective, then there were good amount of developers who were only selling on check. Many corporates, including startups, and other listed companies, even they have not recorded higher sales. So it's not that the sales of the sort of unstructured, unorganized markets are going down. I think it's just dragging everything. So I think quarter four results are not out. When they come out, I think it will lead, it'll show the correct picture. And the net impact of this is that banking will get affected. And there is lots of loans. Everybody knows that loans are getting topped up. And therefore, one will have to sit down and say, look, how are we going to tackle it? Asset values are there, but cash flow mismatch is affecting this market big time. I think there is going to be ripple effect of this to say sales are down, therefore cash flow is impacted, therefore let's talk about what's happening on the banking side. And the big opportunity there for some of the foreign investors who are listening and who are on the call is about refinancing. Aidan, I'm sure that, you know, Mr. Lender, Richard will cover this to say how structures are changing, how laws have changed to make enforcement easier on these securities and what's going to happen. Ultimately, the most effective thing in demonetization is the land. Virtually no land trade all of last year. To talk about that, maybe one or two. So they had slowed down prior, after demonetization zero. Now people are waiting for land price to correct, and therefore even if you had the firepower and you had the appetite to go ahead and buy land for the next 2-3 years, you're waiting for it to correct. So I think these are quantifiable effects, and you know, we can talk about what the economy is going to do, but that's where we are. This leads me, you know, I'm going to ask my friend on the right, Suresh, to say, look, if what I'm saying is right, how do you see this from a foreign buyer's perspective? What are your LPs telling you, and are you guys enthusiastic about the market, more or less, before and after demonetization?
So, thanks, Shobhit. I think just on the demonetization, how it pans out, as Michelle Biles said, you know, we just have to see how it all kind of evolves over a period of time. There's not several sectors which are affected. I think with regards to the real estate as such, I kind of break it down to like 6 or 7 sub-sectors. First, let me start with the sectors. We don't think media largely impacted, so we've covered a few of them. So I think office, unless you're doing a lot of strata, if you're like generally doing the lease market, you're largely not impacted. Hotels, again, if you're at 4-star and above, you're largely not impacted. 90 to 95% of your room reservations, everything goes through cards or corporate booking and things like that. There might be some F&B events and some F&B revenue, which got impacted for a little bit for a few weeks, but largely, you know, they're back on track. Industrial / warehouse space, again, we didn't see a major impact. I think that will be, again, it's a lease market. I think in the organized market, you'll be largely fine. I think the sectors which are likely going to be impacted is retail, residential, plotted land, and absolutely the last one is the land sales itself. With regards to retail, you know, there was a temporary slowdown we've seen across some of the properties which we track. But, you know, that's starting to come back up. It's not uniform. It really depends on the product. So, you know, some of the discretionary saw a more slowdown. Some of like the grocery and those kind of stuff, like the hyper cities of the world, you know, actually saw more business coming to them in the initial weeks when the whole demonetization impacted what you could actually buy on the street. But largely, you know, I kind of agree with Shobhit's assessment. I think between March and April, I think, you know, we go back to the normal in the retail. And in terms of what this does for governance too, I think with the digital push the government is giving, I think in the Western market, the revenue share is a very common phenomenon. It's starting to happen in India and in larger a lot of the larger malls. But I think with this digital push, where it's going to be a lot more transparent, I think that's what is going to happen. You want to see a lot more of the mall owners, developers, willing to kind of move into that revenue sharing model. I think because there's a lot more comfort they will have, given that, you know, a lot of this is going to get pushed to the digital transactions. On residential, our view is that, yes, it's kind of impacted the demand. Depending on the numbers you look at, you know, there are several market agencies, you know, who forecasted, you know, falling prices to, you know, I've said something recently where they talked about 44% drop in demand and all that stuff. But I think if you look at the longer picture, and that's how we look at it, is I think what this has done is to help, you know, improve the transparency in the sector. I think you will see that there will be a few months when people kind of sit and wait out to see the prices are going to correct or not correct. But what the government is trying to do, which is to kind of get cheaper home loans done, and with the speculated, you know, incentives which are going to come through in the budget, we believe the longer term story of residential is going to be intact. But the pain is going to last, in my view, between 6 to 9 months. And, you know, we can debate whether it's impacting the middle house or the luxury product. But I think there is going to be impact. I don't think, you know, you're going to see blockbuster sales happening in the next couple of quarters. I think some of these have to kick in. People have to make a decision if that's the right point or not. And then also, it's not just, you know, the sales are so run because everyone was paying in cash. It's because also consumer sentiment. You know, a lot of people don't know what it means to their employment based on this demonetization. Is there going to be any retrenchments and things like that? There's a lot of hype which goes around, but I think people are just taking it, just being cautious. But I think it will kind of work out. And then in terms of governance, what this does is, I think the small little guys who were still accepting, you know, monies for parkings to floor rises, I think that will also largely come to an end or would reduce significantly and improve the governance. On plotted development, I think plotted development and land sales, I think, in my view, are going to be the most impacted. But I think, again, that's not really on the foreign investor radar. So, you know, we largely focus on all the other property types I've just discussed. But if someone is looking at plotted development and land sales, I think the impact is huge. I think with non-transparent markets to start with, and I think they will continue to be, you know, largely impacted by this. I don't have a personal sense in when they come back, because it also depends on how easy the government makes it for the cash to come back into the system, and how closely it's going to get tracked going forward. I think we will be in for some changes in terms of how you buy land and all these water developments are going to be closely scrutinized going forward by the tax department. So I think you know, the jury's still out on what gets done. I think the governance, you know, it's a great opportunity for some of the developers to put some system in place, make it transparent. I think you know, they can set up a new product and actually take it forward. But that's largely, you know, how we are looking at the space.
If I can ask you, you go ahead. If on a scale of 0 to 100, are you happy, 100 being very happy, how would you rate the organization? Transparency, governance, demand going down?
I think I would say 90. We're very happy. The 10 points I would just think it has impacted some of the cash flows of the projects in the short term, you know, and we would have liked it to be a little more phased manner, but understand from the government that surprises was very important. But otherwise, you know, barring the inconvenience people had to put up with, I think for the sector,
leaving individuals aside. I think it's a very good move. I hope they kind of maintain the discipline. It shouldn't be like back to normal.
And I think somewhere the demand for your kind of capital has just increased.
Yeah, so that's the unsaid part.
Yeah, so you're gonna have to.
Does it mean more deployment?
Yeah, I think so, because I think what you're going to see is a lot of the developers, you know, and it's a winning game, right? So the buyer is out there thinking that the prices are going to come down and he's going to go in there. So if you're the developer, you're trying to look around and see which debt player, NBFC player, private equity player is going to support you through these hard times so that you can sustain your margins. And then eventually, you know, when things go back to the normal, then, you know, everything is back to your plan with some delay. So I think that way we do see a lot of opportunities. There are more deals, I should say, coming to us with more sensible numbers and sensible expectations since someone has come from there.
So you're saying valuations are down? Deals are becoming more attractive, markets are becoming more transparent. More information is available.
I think that's what the...
Is that...
sure, I would agree with...
You have to pick up the positives of this, out of this.
Deals are more attractive, and there's more willingness to do the deal. Valuations, you know, it's a totally different game. You know, it really depends on structure versus valuation. So you can always find a solution to that. But there's no more willingness to kind of move forward with you.
I think just on that point, I think there are two drivers which at least based in our discussions with certain offshore LPs and GPs, etc., come up. So one is, I think, the general sense, I think, what you'd say is probably homogenous. Yes, we are happy, transparency and all of that ethical issues will be concerned. And I think the other is the RERA, the Real Estate Regulation Act, which is just come in place. And one perspective is that certain foreign investors believe that a lot of rights, like, you know, step-in rights, etc., have come into question for them. But at the other, just at the other side, if you look at it, it is going to bring in a lot of transparency into the system by virtue of the real estate regulator. So maybe Abhinav, and I think there's something that you've been looking at it pretty closely. From a private equity investor perspective, how does RERA impact?
I think there are different ways in which RERA could impact the entire cycle for investment. And I think I'm going to take things what Suresh said here, that it's a very good move to bring in governance, but it all depends on how it's executed and it's maintained in the long run, which is what is the question that is out there, I think. In terms of the impact, I think I'm going to break it down into four large points. The first two would be on the investment decision, and the next two would be the rights that you would probably end up taking in the portfolio company. The first one, of course, is on the characteristic of your investment and how you end up being perceived by the regulatory authority in determining who a promoter is. The concept of a promoter, as we all know, has been expanded substantially in the RERA. It now includes the guy who's developing the project, it includes the person who owns the land, and who sells the real. So this becomes important because, you know, in joint development agreements, now you have two guys who are the promoters as opposed to one. It might be a good thing, it might not be a good thing at times. The other aspect is that, you know, in certain structures where you have a holding company or a sort of an O&M company or a development manager, and I think this is something that Mr. Nilachar will be touching upon later in platform views as well, when you have the holding company, which is the development manager, that guy now becomes the promoter as well. So from an investor perspective, that's a good thing because in addition to whatever contractually you may agree, you also have statutory rights and liabilities of the holding company, which might be the substantial entity with these pockets. That's another important thing. And the third thing is that a lot of times what happens is that the investor prefers to take a right to sell you. Now, with the expanded definition of a promoter, that may have to be looked at more closely, because at the end of the day, if you have a right to sell a unit, even upon the happening of certain contingencies, you may also fall within the definition of a promoter if you look at it. So that's something that we have to be more careful about going forward. So it's a positive for the industry overall because the scope of the promoter expands. And of course, when I say positive for the industry, I mean it from a private equity investor perspective. It might not be the same case on the other side of the table, of course. But the rights also need to be carefully looked at to make sure you don't become a promoter.
The second is the question of when to invest. Now, this is one of the most important questions probably under AI with respect to the timing of the investment. Now, as we all know, there has to be a registration under the Act, and we need to have the approvals or the sanction plans, layout plans in place before you go for the approval. Now, that, and the application also includes the title documents, you know, arrangement for title, land, etc. Now, it becomes important because that, in a sense, means that if you are investing for the land, you are sure that there are no approvals. A lot of investors prefer to invest only when the approvals are in place. So this might be more of a positive for them to make sure that it's an objective criteria now that the registration is in place. But on the other side, for developers, it starts funding probably to the extent of at least land acquisition, which leaves them with options like NBFC. Or looking at other options which may not be there. Bank financing may itself be a concern for purchase of land. So keeping that in mind, this is more of a decision which needs to be taken by an investor whether the risk on the approval needs to be taken, which is always the case. So it's more of a statutory and an objective test. There's a subjective test as to what approvals do you want to have in place. But the good part is the sanction plans, the layout plans can be in place before you try to invest. The third thing is, when do you take certain actions once you are into the company? Now, this becomes important because the Act itself recognizes the concept of default of the developer or the promoter. And it has repercussions to that as well, which range from, you know, allowing you to refund their money, and if they choose to stay on to pay interest to them for the period of delay, and which may extend right till, you know, cancellation or revocation of the registration. Now, the problem is that all rights are that of the allottee, of the unit holder, nothing of the investor or the financier. So, what rights do you have and when do you step in? Now, if you wait for the delays to actually kick in, it becomes a little because the rights of the allottee kick in at that point of time. And under the Act, they would be at a better position than you at any given point of time. So, do you preempt a delay, do you preempt a default of the promoter before you step in and take those rights? What rights are available is something we look at in the next section because that's another challenge right now. But when exactly do you step in and start taking those rights? Do you wait for the default to happen? At this point, it might be very late for you from a statutory perspective, despite what you might have agreed to contractually. So that's another important issue that needs to be taken as to when exactly do you take actions against the promoter, against the developer, for there to actually be a period of for there to be a period of you being able to enforce whatever rights you have. Which of course brings me to what rights do you have. ERA opens a bunch of challenges in terms of what security you can take. Separate rights, as I think Richard mentioned earlier, have been restricted. So separate rights needs to, you know, get approval from a number or from a particular majority of the allottees which is still provided. Even after that, it's not that easy. The allottees have a right to appoint a developer in place of them. If they don't, the authority will appoint another developer. So that becomes another concern as to would you actually be able to step in, because then you are, in a sense, at the mercy of the allottees to become the new developer. With respect to mortgage of land, again, that becomes another challenge because although you may take the mortgage of land, and if everything is going fine, it's absolutely all right. But if it isn't, then in a sense, what you're trying to do is you're trying to take over the land from the promoter, which becomes another issue because the change of the promoter is permitted again only with the approval of the allottee and with the approval of the authority. So it's going to be, you have to wait and see as to how the authority actually reacts to enforcement of these rights. The next one would be pledge of shares. Now, pledge of shares has its own set of challenges because if you have a holding company structure, the promoter itself may be a holding company and the promoter is not allowed to transfer its rights in the project without the approval of the authority and allottee. So will a pledge of share also tantamount to a transfer of rights is something which is again quite unclear in the Act. We'll have to see as to how the authority takes care of this. And the last one, and which is something which is most important, is the cash flow. Now one way where investors drew a lot of comfort was the reflecting of the cash flow through escrow mechanisms and, you know, other arrangements that we had. However, RERA now imposes an obligation for you to have a separate bank account into which 70% of these revenue received from allottees are required to be deposited into, and that can be used only for the purpose of construction
and for the purchase of land. So that becomes another challenge in the larger context of things as to how exactly is an investor now comfortable with the fact that the cash flows are for it to take from. That, again, is not something which is very clear. There have been suggestions and ideas that, you know, if a developer actually ends up purchasing land before the project revenue starts coming in, refinancing those acquisition costs may be considered to be, you know, amounts that can be taken off the 70.
And I think we also think it should be possible.
Yeah.
So retirement of historical land acquisition costs, I think, should be the land acquisition costs, and that should at least be enough.
So, but Alina, what about interest and principal repayment? Would that come out of that 70%? What's the view on that?
So I think the 70% is something which is locked in for the construction. The other 30% is free. So whatever money that can be taken out from there can be used to repay the financing guy or the investors in this case. That can be used as a promoter and to registration. So what the quality of the act primarily wants is that the money is there for construction development. There is some sort of security that, you know, it's not a scheme where once the money starts coming in, you are siphoning it off to a third party or to a related party, which happened a lot of times due to service payment, etc. So I think that's something which the authority now wants to block. In fact, the revenue that are being taken out from the account also, the cash that are being taken up from the account also are on the certification by an architect, by target accountant, etc. So the act has tried to bring in the bells and whistles to make sure that the money is not siphoned off. But how that is up for the investors is a completely different question. Actually hurting them in the long
term. But is the cost of no construction cost? It can be, because otherwise how you take construction funding from somewhere.
Right.
So to the extent that you're retiring that cost, I think it should be fine.
Yeah.
But, you know, the typical concept that people used to have, you know, I'm going to take 30% of that funding also, and those project cash flows should also now be pledged to me, and this should also be pledged to me. I think all those questions will come into question, because for those respective projects, each project 30% has to be allocated to the construction cost for that particular project. So the overarching private equity mandate that, you know, give me everything, whatever, you know, you have on your battle, I think that can come into question.
Just a quick practical question on this. Do we really have to worry about delays from a developer perspective? Won't it be much like the airline, which adds 15 minutes to your travel time and says you're on time? Won't developers add 2 years to your delivery time and say we are well within the time?
The problem is when you go to get your approval, you're adding the 2 years at that point of time.
That's right.
So as an allottee, when I am buying a flat, I have already in a paper saying that the flat will be delivered to me at T+2. So if I've taken that call at that point of time, I think as an allottee, I should be comfortable. And it may be 4 years, I maybe take 6 years, as you said, the developer might ask for 6 years. But if I've taken that call, I think I should be fine. If I'm the developer delivers in 4 years, I should be very happy.
I think to some extent, if you get certainty, you should be happy. So I think, Michelle, I think one of the major developments that has happened is the amendment of the India-Mauritius tax treaty and the India-Singapore tax treaty. So I think the happy days for some of the friends here for zero tax, I think, are probably gone. So I think it is really a time when I think, you know, people are looking closely at some of these treaties, and I think there's an inclination towards that. But I think there's also perspective of still achieving tax-neutral structures, even post the amendment. So maybe you want to just...
Sure. So before I talk about the treaty, I think just one point on demonetization from a lawyer's perspective, and this is how it's going to affect documentation, right? So typically before the investor invests in a company, there is always this material adverse change clause, which is there. There is something between signing and closing, and they will have the right to back out of the transaction. Now, the trend has always been that only if there are some regulatory approvals required, if the time between signing and closing is going to be, you know, more than a month, 2 months, 3 months time, then you have this clause. With the demonetization happening, what we have started seeing is even if there is a gap of 1 or 2 days, the investors want to insist that this material adverse change clause needs to be there, because our prime minister can come anytime on TV, announce anything, and in fact, you know, we were interestingly discussing that in force majeure clause also, after act of God, we need to act of Modi. You know, because at least God gives time, he doesn't give time. So I think this is
something which has changed, and now at least there is not much negotiation. The time between signing and closing is just 2-3 days, and hence they should not be there because people know this is a reality. Modi, we all know, has, you know, a lot of plans, you know, till 2019 on various things. Anything can come anytime, so you all have to be prepared for it. Just coming back to the treaty, I think a lot of things have changed in the last 10 years. If you see, traditionally, as far as India is concerned, there have been 4 jurisdictions which have been used the maximum for investing into India. Mauritius, Cyprus, Singapore, and Netherlands. Now, if you take time period from 2005 to 2012, and this was also 2005 to 2009 was also the, you know, honeymoon period for real estate funds and the developers in India, where everything was being invested and into, and you know, all tier 1, 2, 3, 4 cities all used to get investment from private equity funds. But what happened was at that time there were a lot of equity deals which used to happen, and Mauritius was always good for equity deals because capital gains were exempt in India, and the Mauritius entity was transferring shares to an Indian company. Similar was the case with Cyprus. Cyprus also gave full capital gains tax exemption on transfer of equity shares. And at the same time, Cyprus also gave advantage on the interest withholding tax, which was just 10%, which was, you know, the lowest which, you know, India offered to any country from where debt investment was coming in. So the structure which was used from 2005 to 2011-12 was for equity investment, Mauritius was used. For debt investment, Cyprus was used. Now, there are 4 or 5 things which happened between 2012 and 2013 which completely changed the focus from Mauritius and Cyprus to Singapore and Netherlands. And what were those 4 or 5 things? First was in 2012, Cyprus got hit with the banking crisis, which actually shook the confidence of all the international investors who had come to Cyprus. After 2012, we haven't seen any new investment being routed through Cyprus because this is something which is this blot on the reputation is going to be there for quite some time. Second interesting change which happened was the government of India notified Cyprus as a non-cooperative jurisdiction, because of which any payouts to Cyprus entity from India were subject to a withholding tax of 30%. So again, that made Cyprus very unattractive. The third thing which happened was Singapore was watching all this, that, you know, in spite of being the best places for the fund managers to live amongst these 4 jurisdictions, they were not getting their share as far as the setting up of funds was concerned. So they started changing their own tax regime to make it more conducive for the GPs to set up their funds in Singapore. And which is where we saw some of the interesting provisions on 13X, 13R, 13Z, under the Singapore Income Tax Act, where the funds were given total 100% exemption from any income earned by these funds. So Singapore started getting popularity because of that, because one of the issues with Singapore had before this amendment was that any income which Singapore entity earned from transfer of shares of Indian company, even though it was considered as capital gains under the treaty, there was a risk that it could be considered as business income under the local Singapore tax laws, resulting in 17% tax in Singapore. So that structure didn't make sense for the GPs to set up their fund in Singapore. The fourth thing which happened was the government, for the first time, it had introduced GAR as a concept in the direct tax code, which was introduced as in the draft form in 2010. And then if you see in 2012-13, the government also introduced the concept of GAR in the Income Tax Act. Obviously, we all know it got deferred by 4 or 5 years and it's scheduled to be implemented from 1st April 2017. But the funds, the GPs who are setting up new funds, they had to obviously take the next 10 years into perspective because the typical fund life is 8 to 10 years. So they realize that at some point in time, GAR is going to come in. And Mauritius or Cyprus may not be the best jurisdiction for setting up a fund for investing in India. And obviously, one of the important tests for GAR was, you know, is that if your senior employees or senior decision makers are sitting in that jurisdiction, it's a big plus to defend, you know, the treaty from a GAR perspective. And which is where a lot of new funds, which were set up in 2012, 2013, they started setting up you know, these funds are set up in Singapore, with, you know, some of the senior decision makers sitting in Singapore. And another thing which happened was there was a shift from equity to debt, again, from 2005 to 2012, if you see, the first 5 to 7 years, equity was the preferred mode of investment in India. And then we saw the resurgence of debt, and a lot of debt deals happening for investment in India. And for debt, again, Singapore has a good tax treaty with India, with 15% withholding taxes, which was also quite decent from a tax planning perspective. So this 4 or 5 things changed Mauritius and Cyprus as a preferred jurisdiction in 2005 to 2012 to Singapore and Netherlands. And Netherlands also started being popular. In fact, we set up the first investment platform for Godrej Properties and APG. You know, this was something done in 2012. And Netherlands became very interesting because even today, even though all the three treaties have been amended, India, Singapore, India, Mauritius, and India, Cyprus, the capital gains tax benefits have been taken away. The Netherlands treaty has still been untouched, even though there are reports that government is planning to renegotiate that. But as of today, there is a complete tax exemption for capital gains if a Dutch entity is selling shares of an Indian company to a non-Indian resident. And which is where Netherlands has become more popular along with Singapore. Now, what has happened in the last 9 months? There were three treaties which the government of India amended. India-Mauritius, India-Singapore, and India-Cyprus. Now, what changed in these treaties? These treaties say that all the investments made in shares in an Indian company prior to 31st of March 2017 will be grandfathered, which means that the entities in these three jurisdictions will be able to take the capital gains tax exemption benefit in India. All investment made post 1st of April 2017 from these three jurisdictions will be taxable in India. So there will be a tax which will have to be paid by these entities. For Cyprus, it's a blanket tax which has been introduced for the Indian tax. For Mauritius and Singapore, the government has given a two-year cooling off period where the tax rate will only be 50%. But overall, as Ruchir rightly mentioned, the 0% tax regime for private equity funds coming to Mauritius, Singapore, and Cyprus has ended. Government had realized that, you know, the international investors coming to these jurisdictions don't pay tax. So rather than letting go the tax, why not reduce the capital gains tax in India? And that was a more, in fact, earlier if you see the capital gains tax was, long-term capital gains tax was 20%. Government reduced it to 10%. Now 10% tax is not that difficult for any fund to digest as compared to 20 or 30 or 40% tax. So that's the thought process of the government, and based on that they have renegotiated this trade treaty. Question is, post-2017, what is the best fund structure? Do you still need to come to intermediate jurisdiction because now you're investing in shares of an Indian company? None of these three jurisdictions help. And Netherlands also may, you know, the way government is doing, Netherlands also, government also renegotiated with Netherlands to take over the capital gains tax exemption benefit. Some people think that coming directly from the home jurisdiction is the best option because anyways 10%, whether I come through, let's say if I'm a US investor, I come through Mauritius or I come directly into India from US, I'm still going to pay 10% tax in India. So why waste money on Mauritius, you know, be the administrator, you know, the company secretary and you know, all those things. But one of the important things, the feedback we have got from LPs is typically all these LPs, they don't like to file tax returns in India because this is something which is a complete no from their side. So because of that reason, we have seen the need for intermediate jurisdiction would still be there because the moment you have an intermediate jurisdiction entity, that entity will have to file tax return in India, not the LPs. I mean, they don't like to get into taking PAN, permanent account number, tax reduction account number, you know, all this procedural hassles is something that they don't want to get into because they invest in multiple jurisdictions and they don't have bandwidth to handle some of this administrative compliance. So they still want to stick to one of the jurisdictions. If you are coming through debt, if you are looking at investing in debt, then Mauritius has now become the best jurisdiction to invest into India. The withholding tax rate on interest when an Indian entity pays to a Mauritius entity has been reduced to 7.5% as compared to Singapore, which is been kept at 15%, Netherlands is 10%, and Cyprus is 10%. So Mauritius has become the best jurisdiction for making debt investments in India. It was earlier the best for making equity investments. Now it's the best jurisdiction for debt investment. So that's also something that, you know, one needs to take care of. And there are, even within these treaties, Mauritius and Singapore, the tax exemption is being taken away only for shares acquired post 1st April 2017. So there are structures which you can still use through Mauritius and Singapore by using, let's say, compulsory convertible debentures or there are two-tier structures which you can use where two entities can be set up and the top co can sell shares of the bottom co and then, you know, there's one structure which can still work even for shares where, let's say Mauritius Company 1 owning 100% of Mauritius Company 2 and Mauritius Company 2 in turn has invested in the shares of the Indian SPV. When the Mauritius Company 1 sells shares of Mauritius Company 2, you fall under the residual article under the treaty and the residual article says that if you have not been covered in the previous paragraph of the article, Mauritius only will have the right to tax you. So even though it's transfer of shares of a foreign company which has 100% of its value derived from India and you get caught in the Vodafone tax, you still get the benefit of the India-Mauritius tax treaty because of which Mauritius entity will not be required to pay any tax from India. But obviously all this is subject to GAAR, General Anti-Avoidance Rules, which is going to come from 1st of April. Nobody knows how the government is going to implement it. But I think one good thing about GAAR which got changed earlier, the way GAAR provisions were worded was if one of the main purpose is to avail of tax benefit, then GAAR will get triggered. And there was a lot of resistance from the industry that when any of us do anything, one of the main purposes is always tax. Even if we invest in PPF, you know, annually 1.5 lakh rupees, the purpose is to get tax benefit. That doesn't mean that you deny the benefit to it. So government changed that concept from one of the main purpose to main purpose for that arrangement is to avail of tax benefit. Now this is going to be quite interesting because you can always justify the commercial rationale for doing something. Even if you are able to find one non-tax justification for doing your structure, you should be able to defend against triggering of GAAR provisions. And that's something, that's where your documentation is going to be very critical going forward. How you write your recitals in the agreement, how you lay down the steps in the structure, and for each and every step in the structure, you need to have some commercial justification. So, just to give an example, why use Mauritius, right? Now, the tax officer can just come back and say that Mauritius, you know, you have used it only for the purpose of earning of tax benefit. But let's say there are U.S. investors in the Mauritius entity. Now, if you see, U.S. investors, U.S. and India, they don't have a bilateral investment protection treaty. And today, the biggest worry of a foreign investor is to protect capital rather than double taxation of income. Only if your capital is there, you will have income, right? So, because Mauritius and India have a bilateral investment protection treaty, that's one very big non-tax justification to use Mauritius. Because you can say my LPs insisted that I want to protect my investment, the investment needs to be protected. If you would have come directly from US, this wouldn't have happened. And, you know, some of these things, but these things need to be built in the document when you're setting up the fund. When the tax officer questions, and, you know, if you give, then, you know, the importance of some of those funds reduces. So what we specifically do when we're setting up funds in Mauritius, the first application that goes to Financial Services Commission for registering the fund, that application we cover 8 to 10 points, which are completely non-tax, on why we are using Mauritius as a jurisdiction for setting up of the fund. And that, 5 or 6 years down the line, if there is a question, you can just show that application, that there is not an afterthought. When we set up the fund, all these things are there. Sorry, I've taken
a little short
time. Yeah, I know,
kind of
short. So one of the structure, as you mentioned, is that if the shares of Indian companies. Now, in real estate, one could look at LLP. Then transfer of interest in LLP is not shares of Indian companies. That's one, which is something that can be considered. Secondly, you can use staple stocks. So you can have differential voting rights. So if you transfer convertible debentures, okay, and earn an income, that is not the capital gains on the sale of shares. So you can have majority of the amount coming by debenture and less amount by your shares, but debentures do not have voting rights. So you can structure in a way that one share has 99 voting rights, and then you sell together otherwise. So there are a number of different combinations, but as Nishal mentioned, that we all have to look at all this in light of the new DAR provision. And of course, there are different theories that GAR, domestic GAR can override the treaty, and treaty contains already some kind of a GAR for this limitation of benefits. The article we won't go into details at this point in time. But there are a number of things that one could work on within the go forward. So, but the last point I would make here is that, and this is just edited so that a bit, is documentation. I think this department is not going to look at what is your structure chart. We all are good at designing a great PowerPoint and great structure chart and all this kind of thing. But all that has to be translated and well articulated in the documentation, whether it's placement memorandum or whether it's agreement or anything, all this has to go into the, that is where we find a lot of weaknesses, you know, the drafting skills.
The emotional justification should be.
Yeah, and also the articulation.
I think we actually have very loud, I think. We probably be delayed by about 15 minutes, I think, because we're more ground to cover. But Suresh, let me come to you quickly. I'm running very short, but just one very, very crisply, you know. I think the debt-equity divide is something that people keep on debating. What is debt? What is equity? And real estate, probably the line is thinning. And it's probably the thinnest. More and more equity deals are happening on the SEB platform. Sometimes there is not even a... you know, any kind of minimum return guarantee, just principal guarantee. So sometimes these are made with a certain amount of downside protection, but maximum, but substantial equity kicker. So I think equity versus debt divide keeps changing, and you know, and changing you know, based on the commercials. But my sense is that, you know, we saw it from coming from pure debt to preferred you know, from pure equity. To preferred equity, to, you know, to equity, structured debt, pure debt, and now I think again we are probably going back in many senses to 2008-9 models where I think people are realizing that, you know, let's do equity.
Sure.
And that's the sense that we are getting from a lot of people. What is your sense? How would you be allocating your capital? Debt, equity, structured?
We at Apollo, we look at opportunity returns, so we can work across the capital structure as well as cultures of return. But let me just take a broad view or broad discussion on the industry-wide what's happening. So pre-2011, it was pure equity, you know, the NCDs or all that, you know, pretty much non-existent. From 2011, you had a lot of these, you know, private equity investors who bought office buildings, and now the retail buildings get bought. I think the next wave, you're going to see a lot of hospitality and some industrial assets which are getting traded. I think key themes, equity themes, I'm not getting into the debt part, which you will see in the next few years, and some you've already seen, is you're going to have these developer-sponsored funds. You know, you have like Godrej, Shapoji, where they're getting equity and making investments, making developments and stuff. You will also see that the guys, the developers with good track record of execution and reasonable capitalization are going to get a lot of money from the investors to kind of acquire projects, land banks, or for, you know, things from weaker developers or listed developers. That's another thing you want to see. And lastly, I think as you kind of go forward, what you want to see that is even some of the listed companies in real estate are not properly capitalized. So that is another opportunity is to sort of capitalize some of the listed companies for them to be able to kind of not go acquire other companies, but to actually, you know, put their house in order, complete the project, and then, you know, escape the work of both RERA and SEBI and everything else. So I think this is where, largely where a lot of the equity money is going to go. And then you're always also going to have a lot of equity money which is going to go towards, what we say, financing investments from the 2011 era. So there are a lot of people who are trying to kind of get out of those projects because of the fund life and cycles and stuff like that. I think a lot of the money will go towards taking over. You know, you see that a lot in the private equity business, not so much in real estate, acquiring secondary interest, or maybe just buying out the thing and then redoing this all over again. I think those are the broader themes you want to see in the next few years, purely on equity. Yeah.
Well, I think that is actually,
that's right. So, Suresh, if equity is going to be coming more and more, is it also that valuations are getting corrected, or is it just because, you know, structurally equity looks better?
I think the equity will come into those projects where two or three conditions are met. One is, you know, I don't think equity will come into each and every developer. I think the private equity investors will go into the top tier developers with execution capability, and where there's meeting of minds in terms of valuation. So gone are those days where you can just show a Excel sheet and say, I'm going to develop 5 million square feet over 5 years at this point. It doesn't happen. I think they're more meaningful, and yes, so it's kind of...
So the underwriting is much better.
It is much better, and the valuation is more realistic. And you don't, like, pay people, you know, or multiples because they were sitting on historical land banks and trying to sell the 30-40% out. And those things don't happen. Everyone insists now their money goes towards developing the project or completing the project, and the cash flows rarely happen. Unless it's a portfolio-level sale.
My friend on my right is saying he's going to do equity deals or could be looking at doing equity deals. Are they really for equity or are they for downside protection?
Yeah.
What are your investors really telling you? When you're writing the documents, they tell me something else, but I want to know what are they telling you when you're drafting those commercials into enforceable documents.
No, geez, I think even the real estate mindset has always been, you know, pay as optimized to be very nice, optimized taxes as you can. So even during the historical 2007-8 days, there was actually very nominal equity and substantial amount of CCDs that were coming in because you would obviously like to expense out as much as you possibly can. And then there was 2008, you know, when we did the first ever NPV transaction. And government of India didn't like debt. And Economic Times had a front page story, you know, that you're doing something very cute and stock exchange is top listing and, you know, SEBI said, what are you doing? So I think it took some time to kind of go through that entire scenario and meet with the regulators and service providers to kind of get that act clear. And I think today, if you see, I think Shobhit, it was probably your report that last year, so I think 2015 or 2014, 75% of the offshore capital came into India, whether it was equity debt or whatever. I don't think you clarified. I think the report clarified that as much. Maybe I missed out. But all of it came through the structured debt or the NCD product. Now, and I think to a large extent, we are opening up that route further. So just for those people who do not know this very well, an Indian company can issue redeemable non-convertible debentures to any non-resident, which is registered as a foreign portfolio investor. And that foreign portfolio investment registration and regime has been extremely simplified to such an extent that, you know, there's something called as a Category 3 where almost any non-resident can actually procure a regime within a couple of weeks' time. So it's extremely simplified. Now, earlier the challenge used to be that the debt instrument which the Indian company issued had to be mandatorily listed. And many times, you know, the offshore investors who were looking at it and Indian companies said, you know, this is too much of a pain, you know, who's going to list it? Especially for small ticket sizes, you know, kind of became a challenge. Now, it kind of works really well because as per a recent amendment, two things have changed. One is that you no longer need to list your debentures also. Even unlisted debentures can be subscribed to by a non-resident, provided that you are not using that for the purpose of land acquisition. So if it is for not land acquisition, but if it is for construction funding or whatever, you are free to raise money from offshore sources, even without listing the debenture. Naturally, I think most of
people are pretty seasoned, you have to realize that most of these debentures had two components. One was an interest and one was redemption premium. And redemption premium really was a function of any variable which you could commercially decide. In most cases, it would be a function of cash flows. So therefore, cash flows went up, redemption premium went up, and therefore, whatever the company paid out, that form of redemption premium was an expense and optimized your taxes. Now, and I think today, in today's time, when actually equity has no benefit left, and any non-resident which is investing, by the way, long-term has to pay at least a 10% tax, there is a contemplation that why not actually structure all your investments using debt route, wherein you actually build it up as interest expense, redemption premium, which gives a substantial reduction to the Indian company. I think that has been one change. Another major change which has happened is this, that, you know, debt, many people, many foreign investors, fear the risking, you know, return was one part. Even the principal was at risk in India, you know. So, and the challenge was the security creation. PCG did not allow it, but LTD has allowed it, but people thought that, oh, will I be stuck up in a recovery food for decades and decades in India? Another change which has happened, which is a very substantial change, which has recently happened, is that SARFAESI protection, which was hitherto available only to banks and certain notified financial institutions, has now been extended to all secured lenders which are acting through a debenture trustee. So basically, FPI entities that are investing through a debenture trustee now get SARFAESI protection. Now what does SARFAESI mean? It actually is a very, very fast track route of getting constructive possession. Because usually, the ICICI banks and state banks would spend decades just trying to prove that there is a due to them, you know, even though it was on the face of it. And then because of Indian courts and the labor and time, you would get stuck. But now, the moment you give a notice, 30 days you don't pay, unless you're able to defend it, and that defense also goes to DRT, which is a very fast-track, tribunal, the lender automatically gets constructive possession. You can tell it now, it's a separate matter that even in India, even that is a bit of a challenge. I think we are working to resolve in bankruptcy, a lot of other things. But it's a much, much, much fast-track process. It actually gives you teeth, a substantial teeth. Now, I think there is some kind of a technicality which I think Governor is discussing, that probably that benefit may not be available for unlisted entities, but only for listed debentures. But that we can kind of look at it. I think he's quite certain that only for listed, people for listed. But I think that's one way. Now, again, from a GAR perspective, questions sometimes come, that how much should be debt and how much should be equity? And I think generally the market standard just for everyone's benefit, generally he's seen is that if you maintain a 1:6 kind of a ratio, 1 being equity and 6 being debt, generally you should be able to say that, you know, it is not in capitalization. So even post-GAR, a 1:6 structure can typically be defended is what generally, you know, kind of people believe. Obviously now that's how aggressive tax law is going to be.
You are saying that equity is actually coming in, commercial equity.
Commercial equity.
But when you are subscribing it, you are converting that into 1/6 and the balance as some sort of debt structure to make it tax efficient. But from a commercial standpoint, it's not debt, it's not old. If it defaults, there is no chance of it defaulting. Right? I'll come back to you on this one again, but I'm going to quickly go to Nishin. This is talking about platforms becoming fashionable, and there are lots of growth that have been done already. That means a single investor or probably doing a partnership with a joint venture with a corporate or a high-quality developer. What are the key challenges that you found, and what is the one thing that you worry about in these structures? Because these structures have never gone to court so far. Like, equity is gone, debt is gone, spoken about subsidy. What happens if platform fails?
So interestingly, again, this is another shift which we have seen, in the last decade. If you see, 2005 to again 2012, we saw a lot of blindfold funds where LBs were, trusting the GP and based on that investments were made in India. But the fact of life is if you are walking blind, you are bound to fall into a pool. And that's where the blind pool started getting unpopular because they started losing money, right? And that's where we started seeing the platform structure, because LPs decided that it's best for us to deal with the developer directly rather than have an intermediary in the form of the GP. And if you see from 2012, we have seen number of platforms between the LP and the developer directly. The first one being the Dutch pension fund with Godrej Properties. The other platform which we saw was CPP and Piramal. You know, we have seen Tata Macquarie and a lot of platforms that started. There are hardly any blind pool funds which are there, not only in real estate space, even if you see private equity space or non-real estate private equity, it's the same thing. So clearly the trend is for the platforms to set up, and one of the key reasons is also that earlier where the investors were chasing a lot of developers for multiple deals, they realized that it's better to focus on few reputed solid developers and, you know, do a partnership with them. Rather than doing 10 deals with 10 developers, better to do 10 deals with one developer. You know, so rather than flirting with many, just get married to one. And that model actually started working quite well for some of the platform deals. Now, one of the things in the platform is typically in platform deals, the developers do get locked in with the investor because they, whatever project comes in, has to be offered to the right of first refusal with the investor. But if you look at it from an investor perspective, typically there is no commitment with the investors to make that whatever projects are offered to it, they have to accept it. So from an investor's perspective, it's not a bad idea to look at some of these models. Plus, you know, if you see the way these platforms have been set up, you know, they all have been done with all the reputed developers. So Godrej Properties, Tata Housing, or Shapoorji. And which is where I think, you know, we see this trend continuing. We are actually, you know, working on a couple of other platforms, not specifically in RE, but, you know, it's very sector very close to RE. But I think as far as documentation is concerned, I don't see too much of challenge, you know, going from a lawyer's perspective. Yeah.
Including with RERA and with...
RERA is something which is going to impact all...
Will it need to undo if these platforms are to backfire?
See, RERA is something is not specific to platform. Even for a normal foreign investor who invests in a project SPV, he will face the same problem when, you know, platform structure...
So,
or
RERA, you are more aligned.
Is not going to
so,
be
now you are together. So, now you better believe that you are the developer.
So, it's actually more in favor of the platform.
Yeah, I mean, you keep dealing with the same developer.
No,
it goes against the... It goes against Warren Buffett's principle.
So,
right,
you
would
have...
Will you
do a platform?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's the way forward, I think, for both the developers and some of the fund managers. Is to have deep pockets lined up, these who have a very specific focus, and you know, they get to see the deals, the investments.
But this is a very important question which many people ask. I think from all quarters, even in the way, I think it's a very important question. There are only very limited set of developers.
That's
right. Those set of developers are probably being chased by everyone. So I think there, so it's always a question of too much capital chasing too little developers. So I think
we are generalizing the investment platforms only to developers, but there are few cases like Kotak is raised money from Piramal is raised from CPMG, Kotak is raised from GIC, Metico is raised from Magic. So it is also to the fund manager. It is not developer specific. So I think even those are investment platforms, and I think as private equity funds, I think we have a specific capital lineup with a strategy which we can agree, and where the investor gets to see these investments. I think it's a good thing for the market and overall for longevity of investing in India. I think it's a good move.
We've spoken a lot on demonetization, tax structure, and RERA. Come to one last subject with these. I think, you know, these regulations have now been well defined, well regulated. That we've recently issued further notifications. They've informed the stock exchange on rules of listing these deeds. And I do believe that it's a good liquidity event for the industry to keep these assets institutionalized. And when I'm saying institutionalized, it simply means Grade A assets will remain under single ownership and not become starter title like all of Nariman Point, and therefore is very difficult to redevelop it, to bring it back and make it more meaningful for the society. But REIT is well deserved, obviously both from developer, bank and unit holders perspective. I'm going to just straight jump into Mr. Gwynedd's piece enough to say, which is, what do you think?
I think there's a larger commercial issue, which is that if you are getting, the Indian REIT story, the Indian yield story is not that great. Now, the problem is that Indian real estate industry, when it comes to core assets, says, this is my yield, but you know what, it is less, so I'm going to throw a little bit of capital growth also.
That's right.
Right? But the problem is that from the investor side, they either like yield playing or they like playing in the capital growth too. So if they want to invest in capital growth, then I'd rather be in that market and invest in under construction. The insurance company, the pension funds are actually more keen on the yield play. Now, that is where I think there's a bit of a mismatch. And, I think the massive interest is not even from developers, because even developers, larger developers whom we spoke with, and we went to a substantial extent when recently we were involved substantially in the drafting, etc., of regulations also. The developers said, they compare this, saying that I'm going to put in so much of effort, why don't I just do NRD or TMBS? So that is one separate debate. From an investor perspective, it is about, does it really matter? Because if you see, there is global capital, and if it's yield play, then probably it can go to some of the more developing markets that take political risk, regulatory risk, tax risk in India. So tax, and unfortunately, the way REIT regulation, the taxation is worked, is kind of devised. It's such that it makes only sense when there is a non-resident which is investing, because that is where you typically get the 5% withholding. For Indian residents, there's a 30% tax on land, which kind of defeats the entire purpose. So that's a, we have read compendium here, a compilation of some of the articles that we've read. You can look at it. But I think REIT is only one aspect. I think commercial assets or commercial real estate is really picking up. We are currently evaluating two separate core asset platforms with around $400 million. I think that is where I think there is substantial amount of interest. But again, I think from core asset perspective, just two things that I want to tell, or you should keep in mind, is some, there is a perception that almost every core asset has been opened up. That's not correct. What is the FDI policy in almost all foreign investments still restrict real estate business. What they say is that if you are in a completed asset, which is a township or a business center or a shopping complex, then you are exempted from complying with the and foreign investment can come in, but provided that you are operating and managing the asset. The important aspect which we all need to keep in mind is operation and management. If you cannot be investing in a company and say, like a PropCo OpCo structure or a hospital, you have a hospital PropCo company which is only earning lease rental income, you come in there and say, I'm only earning lease rental because there is no value add. There is, you're not taking a business risk. That is not what the regulator wants, which we clarified in our discussions as well. So, bear in mind, when you're investing in core assets, there must be an element of operation and management involved. You can, of course, outsource certain functions. That is not a problem. But the core responsibility has to be of that entity where the foreign investor is investing. Or this participation has to be there.
It's not about just collecting rent.
It's not just about collecting rent in the end. And also, just one more thing, for those people who actually want to do this, there is a, the AIF regime, the alternate investment fund regime has been amended recently. So you can pool in capital into an AIF, which is owned and controlled by a domestic fund manager. All the investments that come into such AIF are considered domestic. Then you can do whatever PropCo structures, etc., what you want. But don't do it directly. I think that is where some people are getting a little lost. Great.
Good. I'm assuming it's already 5:45, I think. We can all on the floor. This side of dais can keep talking, but I think...
Yeah. So I think we'll just take... We'll just take questions from the call for the about 250 participants.
Yeah.
And then we'll just spend about 10 minutes on the call, and then...
We are available here after the...
Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one on the touchtone phone. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star and two. Participants are requested to only use handset while asking a question. Ladies and gentlemen, we will wait for a moment while the question queue assembles. Participants who wish to ask questions, please press star and one at this time. A reminder to participants, anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one.
Okay, so, you know, you were mentioning on RERA that 70% of sales proceeds have to be deposited. So just taking a hypothetical example, let's say 100 rupees is going to be the total inflow on a project sales value. And construction cost has got to be 40. And land value will be 40. Now, land value, do you actually have to pay today? Or you can, if you have partnered with a landowner, so there's a partnership between a developer and a landowner.
So partially pay that land.
So it's a joint development agreement. So what happens there? So if you have not, you assume the notional current value or historical value.
Now the problem is that, you know, this was one of the points that was raised. In fact, this is also a recommendation that was made in the Maharashtra rules were out to clarify this. So issue is that when they talk about cash flows, they are not willing to let the notional income concept come in there. Now, and the exact issue that you mentioned is currently also there. We are dealing with a couple of clients who are facing the same issue where they have JDA. They think, I don't have a land expense cost today, but it's going to be in the form of units tomorrow. So I think what the sense there is that in that sense, you will not, in that case, you will not even be receiving the cash flows for those particular units. So they are looking at it as if it's an offset on both sides. So the thing is, because of the fact that if out of 10 core units are not being sold to a third party, you're not getting the cash flows also.
I mean, if you want a very simple answer, it's probably this amount, right? They are probably thinking about it, but
they cannot
get reimbursement on notional value.
So, technically, if...
you can, by the way, sorry, just to... There is actually in the rules, there is a provision where you...
For revaluation
also, and you have to give an estimate of how much expense will go where all. So now, and those rules, even we believe are pretty impractical actually, because how can you give on day one all the estimate that you have to give, right? So that is an estimation that you have to give. Based on that, you can probably draw out. And if you give a very high estimate, probably you can be, you know, you can be pushed.
So technically, just continuing with the same example, 40 rupees of construction cost, 40 rupees of land cost. And so even though you collect 70 rupees from the customer, you will still have to keep the entire 70, even though your actual cash outflow will be 40.
Now, yes, on that, there is a particular provision which says that the 70% keeps on reducing proportionate to your extent of completion of the project. So, if it's 100% less than 40 rupees is the construction cost, from the way it looks like now, yes, 70 will have to be kept.
Actually, you talked about to be very simply answered, if they allow all these things, then you will defeat the purpose of RERA, because I'm sure there are enough brains in this industry to create these values and take that money out, right? The idea, very simply from a consumer perspective, is to ensure that the project is finished. If it started, it is finished, right? And there's sufficient money at all points of time. So from a very government stand perspective or consumer perspective, they don't want to allow these clever structures to talked about various jurisdictions. UAE has also been in the news of late, and a lot of people are saying that that's another jurisdiction that will be friendly for investors to come in. What's your view on that? There is no treaty, I know, but...
No, there is a treaty. But it's, UAE never gives capital gains tax exemption benefit to companies. Mm-hmm. Only good part about UAE treaty is the withholding tax is 12.5%. Which is still more than it was in Cyprus, Netherlands, and now Mauritius at 7.5. So, UAE one is international LPs have not been comfortable setting up
a pooling vehicle in UAE. That's more from a political risk issue more than a tax issue. But even from a tax perspective, UAE doesn't help, you know, as much as some of the other jurisdictions.
It's not a friendly jurisdiction.
Become liable in case of there is some disorder or whatever. So how do I restrict myself or, you know, pay myself from the operating the developer's liabilities basically? If he does something like, you know, with some flouting with the rules and regulations and all.
So I think that's common across, in fact, all regulations, not just RERA. In fact, any law that you pick up, including Companies Act, for example, there is the officer in default concept, where the director who's in control of the operations of the company would be liable for the acts of the company. So it's not specific to RERA. Having said that, it's all about your decision making or your participation in all the decisions that are being taken, which might not be in accordance with the act. Your objecting to decisions which are not in accordance with the act, etc. And your level of involvement in each of those decisions becomes important. So it's a subjective thing that needs to be seen on a case-to-case basis, but it's something which is...
So RERA doesn't change the idea. You should then the documentation you should put in your default
copy. Okay. How do you see the insolvency in the bankruptcy code affecting the enforceability of the security for the creditors, for the lenders?
See, the... you'll have to see how it, because I think it is still a little work in progress. Now, there's obviously a faster mechanism. You know, there's part A and there's part B, there's a resolution mechanism. If you set it up in 180 days, there's officer if you don't do it. But I think there's still a lot of, you know, gray areas there, right? Because I think what can happen is that if the resolution officer is not able to reach a resolution, if you reach a resolution, then it has to be done. It has to be implemented. But if even a certain creditors, etc., back out and they won't, you know, support, then I think it can go into a little bit of a loop. And I think it's still work in progress. Let's comment on it when we, you know, when it gets finally
I'm going to go to the first example where he said that, you know, the property is available on joint venture, 40 rupees is the cost of the land, 40 rupees is the cost of construction, and 100 rupees is the total sale. So if a developer had to go and raise money from our friend, say, Apollo, for the construction, and he got the land in joint venture, how much would he have to put in a bank? 70% of 80 rupees or 70% of 40 rupees?
But it's 70% is the collection. It's not on your construction cost, so it's all on your collection. So if you collect it 10 rupees over a first few weeks,
okay,
you put in 7. As it goes on, you keep it up to 70% of your collection. And of course, up to the cost of construction.
I think that's even the revenue. Just keep it on protecting the consumer, not the investor.
Okay.
Thank you. So, I think
that's with the advent of so much of regulation and so much of clarity coming in, it probably is a question for Shobhit or next 1 year from the following. Do we see that there is two things happening? One, whether there is no long-term capital available. Second, is the expectation of return, especially out of growth assets, is the word growth assets here, reducing as we go forward? Or is, so two things. Is there more patient capital, so to say, available? Two, is the capital available a little at a cheaper rate as compared to what it was?
Yeah, I think with all this transparency and the governance process, I think we'll see a more normalized return. Now, what exactly the number is, again, would still depend on the project and everything, but I think certainly it's also a factor of what's happening on the debt markets, right? So you cannot have a huge disconnect between equity returns and debt returns. So I think we're moving towards a more normalized return matrix going forward. And I think a lot of these risks will get priced in. You know exactly you have to pay 10% in capital gains tax, which is, you know, I think there's clarity. So I think more and more of these are getting clarified. I think with this RERA, a lot of the private equity investors and their interest will be protected. There's still a gray area about what happens, as Abhinav said, that, you know, there's a default, how do you actually go about changing the developer and how do you kind of foreclose and all that.
But otherwise, you know, leaving that aside, I think it's generally positive and we believe it will be more normalized.
So I think we just probably, I think, head out. But just one last time, Mukesh, if you can just check if there's any question on the call, if they're lining up. Otherwise, we'll just probably then take questions till the, you know, at cocktails.
Got a question from Audio Bridge from Arpit Agarwal from LIC Asset Management. Please go ahead.
Myself is Ullas Pillai from LIC HFL Asset Management Company. Hello.
Yes, listen, please go ahead.
Yeah. Now my question is that, you know, in some of the housing finance companies, they fund up to 70% or sometimes up to 80% of the cost, construction cost of the project. And considering the land value is an historical one, it will be a very negligible cost. Okay, now you said that the repayment has to be made from the 30% that is going for the land cost. So how is that, you know, when we make funding for 70% or 80% of the construction?
No, I did not say that. 70% is for construction and land cost.
Okay.
So you can discharge the land cost from the 70% allocation.
And my question is that how the principal repayment will be made, out of 30% or out of 70%?
Whatever cash flows are free, you can use it for whatever purpose you want.
30% is free, 70% can be used for land cost, construction funding cost, interest cost,
and clarify, yeah.
I just want to
Shubhit raised the question before about where could platforms fail, what could be the problems. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this. We didn't get an answer to that, you know, from a commercial perspective and from a legal perspective.
Can
we
repeat
the
question?
Yes. So I think what Manish is asking is, where is the risk on the platform deals that are happening both either from a between funds and their LPs or between developers and their investors. I think the key risk is that I don't think deals will fail commercially because that equity risk and, you know, equity can either perform or not perform, that's fine. I think the key risk is the partnership risk. Right? That you fail, the partnership itself fails. That means your partner doesn't perform or doesn't follow the governance standards that you anticipated or doesn't show the growth that you wanted. And that's the end of that platform because, you know, we've seen one or two really ineffective platforms. I won't say that they were fake, but they were not effective because people couldn't buy assets or grow those platforms to the level that was required because the partner wasn't aggressive or whatever the issue was.
You start with the thesis and really
I think the risk is either your investment thesis goes wrong or your partnership doesn't really move forward. It's almost like a field marriage. Nothing wrong with the girl or the boy. But
we spent some days together in the failed marriage.
Yes.
And so what happens to those assets created during those days means, are those separate and can be easily separated out?
I think that's it's more of a magnitude issue. Like, you invest, you lose your money in one deal versus you're doing 10 deals together. So typically the way documentation works in this platform deals is there is a lot of cross default provision. There is, let's say, fraud in one SPV, then there is a put call option on all the investments together.
Yeah.
Or there is a liquidation of SPV on all the investment, or there is a preferred return which needs to be given from on the entire investment, not necessarily the SPV in which the fraud has been committed. So the magnitude is much larger as compared to a single investment deal.
Yes.
Otherwise, from an enforceability perspective, you know, the same thing happen. I mean, there's no difference in that. But because of this cross default provisions, where even let's say for one SPV, if there is a event or default that if you take any without matter or affirmative right related decision without the consent of the investor. Now for nine SPVs you might be taking, but for that one you have missed out. Then if it falls under the larger framework agreement event of default, which is it will impact all your nine other SPVs even though there is nothing which has happened in those nine SPVs.
So historically, I think if there's default on one, typically, because there's no meeting of mind,
correct,
then the platform should be wound up, and that would be historically seen. One default, not meeting of mind, you wind up the entire platform,
correct.
There is a put option, call option, that is commercially decided, and certain discount with payment. Or at that time. Great. So I think we will just wind this up. Thank you very much for...
wonderful. Very interactive and with so many issues coming up, but I think there's going to be some.
We are holding cocktails at the building right adjoining.
I think they will be serious. They won't drink that. Am I right? So, but thank you all so much for coming. I mean, I'm very happy. And we hope we continue our relationship and but there are so many nuances that have come up. And I think environment on the whole is improving.
Yes.
At least there has been significant refinement, that's what the trend. And the process is always like that, you know, goes professional. And since they're polished, hopefully in this year, you know, a lot of things happening, irrespective of whatever language you are. Those words, I would say, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.